This program deals with things of an adult nature and is intended for a mature audience.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
We must guard against the military-industrial complex.
Exopolitics, paranormal phenomena, and deep analysis of current world events. From somewhere in the desert, between Area 51 and Roswell, blasting across the planet, the Manticore Network proudly presents Fairy Tales, because the truth will set you free.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
The power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty!
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Sooner or later, though, you always have to wake up.
Be skeptical, but don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Veritas, where we uncover the truth, one guest at a time. For those who dare to seek, Veritas is the place where they shall find. I'm your host, Mel Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, make yourself at home. I want to thank all our members. As always, you are keeping Veritas alive. Tonight's special guest is the Honorable Paul Hellyer, former Canadian Minister of Defense. He will discuss his new book, Light at the End of the Tunnel, a survival plan for the human species. I'm always looking for solutions, and he has lots of them. Paul Hellyer will be with us shortly. To listen to the complete version of this and all our past and future shows, become a member. Veritas survives on your voluntary subscriptions only. You will receive immediate access to this and all our past and future shows. Just head on over to our website, veritasshow.com, click on subscribe, and take Veritas with you. The fall and winter seasons are coming, and you know what that means. Get your MMS right from us. And I've been searching for products and services that I believe in and hopefully put them on our website. And I just found a source for thousands of health supplements at a very discounted price. So go to our website and take a look. If you buy supplements anywhere else, you're paying too much. So click on the link and find out. And if you need to get in touch with me, go to our website and click on the contact button and join me on Facebook. According to the Honorable Paul Hellyer, former Canadian Minister of Defense, elements of the United States Armed Forces have developed exotic energy sources at the massive underground installations in Nevada and Arizona, and have been hiding this from the public for years, if not decades. Full disclosure of this secret information is essential for society to end its reliance on oil. Even the cost of a fast transition would be enormous. In his book, Light at the End of the Tunnel, Paul Hellyer provides a detailed financial plan that would provide nation states with the financial flexibility to effect this transition. Essentially, all they would have to do is use the power that their constitutions provide. If you want to stay in the status quo, stop this audio now. If you want to help change the world, don't go anywhere. Paul Hellyer is coming up next. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Veritas. Music you hear right here on the Veritas show is supplied by the independent artists from Jamendo.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to our homepage, veritasshow.com, click on the guest, look up the song, and download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases right there at Jamendo.com.
This is Paula Harris. I can handle the truth, and I'm ready for disclosure.
The Honorable Paul Hellyer was Canada's youngest member of parliament when he was first elected in 1949, and the youngest cabinet minister appointed to Louis S. Saint Laurent's government 8 years later. Although Hellyer is best known for the unification of the Canadian Armed Forces, and for his 1968 chairmanship of the Task Force on Housing and Urban Development, he has maintained a lifelong interest in macroeconomics. This led him to form Action Canada, a populist movement dedicated to the concepts of full employment and low inflation, with an emphasis on quality of life issues. Through the years, as a journalist and political commentator, he has continued to fight for economic reforms and has written several books on the subject. In recent years, he has become interested in the extraterrestrial presence and their superior technology that we have been emulating. In September 2005, he became the first person of cabinet rank in the G8 group of countries to state unequivocally, UFOs are as real as the airplanes flying overhead. And directly from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, I have the pleasure to introduce the Honorable Paul Hellyer. Hello, Mr. Hellyer, and welcome to Veritas. How are you?
Good afternoon. It's nice to be with you.
It's an honor and a pleasure having you on, sir. And it's not that frequent that we have a former Minister of Defense join us, so we are very privileged, and I hope that we can discuss a lot of topics within the next 2 hours. And for those who may not be familiar with you, please give us some background of yourself. Although the topic of UFO is something you started discussing publicly not that long ago, what circumstances triggered you to start talking about this?
Well, if you're talking about the UFOs, it was really a friend who kept sending me information about it and hoped that I would read it. And for a long time, I didn't have time. But eventually, one of the books he sent me appealed to me, and I took it for a vacation. I'd been intending to do this for a year or so, but never got around to it and could never find it. It was a beautiful disappearing book. Whenever I wanted it, it was never there. So in 2006, I guess, five, and when I was looking for another book that I decided to read on my vacation, I couldn't find it. And lo and behold, The Day After Roswell by Philip Corso was staring me in the face. So I decided that would be a perfect book for my vacation reading, and I took it with me. And one thing led to another from there on.
And it's interesting you mention the late Colonel Corso, because I recently did an interview with somebody, I cannot disclose the name yet for multiple reasons, but he received information from a retired Air Force colonel who validated everything that Colonel Corso has said. And as you know, there has been a lot of debunking, a lot of ridicule for what Colonel Corso had said, but this person validates, and I hope the audience listens to this show. And you have written many books.
Just on that point, before you leave it, Mel, my best sources say the same thing. There are minor things in the book, which was ghostwritten by somebody else. But as far as the
Bill Burns?
Yeah, as far as the substance is concerned, that Colonel Corso was right on the ball.
During your tenure as, and this is a question that just popped in my mind right now, during your tenure as the Minister of Defense, did you come into contact with any information that you've never disclosed before as it relates to UFOs or the technology?
Not really. I got reports on sightings, as I guess all ministers do, and I would take a quick glance at them, and about 80% of them were natural phenomena, or so they said, and about 20% were just unexplained. And this is what I've found since from talking to other people, such as Nick Pope in the United Kingdom, for example, is fairly close to what happens in other jurisdictions, that about 4 out of 5 are natural phenomena, but the fifth one is something that was never explained. And it is in that area that, of course, we've been looking and working, and other people have been working on it for decades, identifying the fact that there were, in fact, unidentified flying objects, flying saucers, visiting the Earth for a long, long time, certainly the last 60 years, but probably for millennia. And so this is now a given fact. When I read Corso's book, I was, of course, at that time an agnostic, I guess, although I had seen the 2-hour documentary on ABC that Peter Jennings had put together, and it was very convincing, I thought. He had a lot of
yes.
policemen and pilots and former government officials who all said that they had experienced something personally. Well, there were a lot of witnesses, and you can't just ignore that many people. They didn't go on the program to make up fairy tales, and so I had been influenced by that. And then, as I read Corso's book, I said to myself, "Is this fiction? I don't read much fiction, but the previous year I'd read The Life of Pi. I don't know how many of your listeners have read that or not, but it's one of those quite incredible books that, until you get to the last few pages, you're never quite sure in your mind whether it's fiction or whether it's fact. And it's only when you get to the end you realize that it is, in fact, fiction. And I said to myself, could this be another Life of Pi? And the conclusion, the strong conclusion, was no, it can't, because I recognized from my defense days the places and the people that Corso was mentioning, that he was talking about. And these were real to me, and I said, no, this is the real thing. Well, then, and this story is well known. As I was reading it sitting by the lake, my nephew Philip came along and asked me what I was reading. I told him, and he said, well, I'm a skeptic. And I said, well, it's a free country. You can think what you like.
Sure.
But he went home, and 2 days later he phoned me and said that he had called the general, as he called him, who was a retired United States Air Force general that he knew, and told him what I was reading, and the general said, every word is true and more. And so that was just sort of the icing on the cake, as far as I was concerned, to have conviction was the word, to go public. But before I did, I got the general's telephone number from Philip. I had met him myself a couple of years earlier, and I gave him a call, and Philip had given him a heads up that I would be calling. And he just started right out by saying, every word is true and more. And we spent 20 minutes or so talking about the and more, which included the fact, as he stated, that there had been face-to-face meetings between U.S. officials and visitors from other planets or star systems. And with that kind of validation, I felt absolutely comfortable in going public, because I felt that there were policy issues. And I'm not a ufologist. I'm not an expert in this field. And in my book, as you know, there's just one chapter on this subject. It's sort of a primer, although I'm told by a lot of people that it has quite a lot of information in it for people who are not familiar with the subject, or who themselves are agnostics or skeptics. And it helps to convince them that the whole thing is real and not make-believe. But this was sort of the scenario that got me involved, is what are the United States Air Force doing? Are they Are they still treating aliens as enemy alien? And what kinds of weapons are they developing now with alien technology that might be used against the aliens and all of these sorts of things? And I said, this is a big public debate, especially in the United States, or should be, but also worldwide, because what is done in these areas could affect the whole world. So that's what really propelled me into going public. And of course, once I did, then I got information from all over the world, books of all kinds and documents, some classified, some not. A lot of bunk, but an awful lot of real pure weed as well, and people calling me and giving me their own personal experiences, and then people who were really knowledgeable in the business wanting to brief me, which they did, and they, you know, included Stephen Greer and all sorts of people who really knew their stuff and told me about their experiences and some of the things that they had learned over long periods of time.
And you have plenty of people listed in that chapter in your book. You have Captain Robert Salas. But I have to ask you, the more that the general explained to you, can you share a little bit of what he said? And did you discuss why the truth embargo continues after 60 plus years?
He didn't go into specifics because I think he still felt bound by his oath.
Right.
So he told me as much as he could without going into specifics, you know, met on a certain airfield on a certain day and all that sort of thing. Of course, I've read a lot about that sort of situation since, and I can't validate it, so I don't talk about it very much. But I know that there have been meetings, and then of course I know that that at least one and probably two or more groups of extraterrestrials have been providing technology to United States forces.
And you have written many books. Your latest one, which will be the focus on tonight's discussion, is called "Light at the End of the Tunnel: A Survival Plan for the Human Species." Give us a summary of the book. Why did you write it? And is there any backstory that inspired you to write it?
Yes. The reason that I went into politics more than 60 years ago was because I was a child of the Depression. And I lived through a period when there was abstract poverty, you know. I had a cousin who later became the best man at my wedding, was an insurance salesman. He was so poor that when he wore out the soles of his shoes, he couldn't afford to have them half-soled. He just put cardboard in the bottom. These were desperate times, you know. So this burned a spot on my soul, which never has gone away. And so after I went to university to sort of get even with the government for wasting my time, first in the Air Force and then in the Army, I decided to try and find out why there has to be recessions and depressions. So I asked my professors at university, and they could never give me straight answers. And I finally figured it out for myself and decided it was a really silly monetary and banking system and that it had to be changed. And so I entered politics with the idea of trying to change it.
It's interesting you mentioned that. When I was in college, I remember asking an economy professor when he was explaining how banks create money. And when I asked him to explain, he really could not explain in a way that we understood it. And now we, of course, know that there's a Federal Reserve and many people, and we'll talk about this throughout the show because I think it's crucial, think that the Federal Reserve is an inclusive entity in the United States, but that's not the case. Many other countries have the equivalent there. But first, how is your book different than others out in the market, and what needs does your book meet that makes it a must-read for someone to read?
Well, the purpose of the book is really to explain, I think, in fairly simple terms, the three things that have to be done to save the planet as a hospitable habitat for the human species. And I've been concerned, and this too is fairly recent, I'm very concerned about global warming. And I'm very concerned about the job that the oil industry has done in the United States in muddying the waters about the science. because if you really look at the best science available, it is absolutely incontrovertible. The globe is rising in temperature. The oceans are rising in temperature. The ice cover is declining. There, I saw a report from your Department of Oceans and Atmosphere recently, mm-hmm. which had about, I think, 12 or 15 different areas that had been tested over, I think, 3 decades. And every one of the indicators was in the wrong direction. So it's happening, and it's happening fast. And I read a book, this is actually after I finished mine, by Dr. James Hansen, called The Floods of My Grandchildren. And I think of it every time the news comes on and you see that terrible, terrible disaster in Pakistan, or the one in India or China. And all of these new phenomena, or apparently new phenomena, of excessively heavy rainfall. And it seems to have a connection to global warming. And Dr. Hansen, I think, thinks that we're on or over the cusp of where we can do anything about it. But I'm an optimist by nature, and so I say we have about 10 years, plus or minus a year or so. But this is compared to what our world leaders are saying, which is, 30, 40, or 50 years. Or if they're not saying it, what they're saying is they're going to cut carbon emissions by a certain percentage by the year 2050, and so on. Well, frankly, that's too late. And the damage will be done, and it will be, by then, irreversible. So that is one of the things that has to be attacked head on. Well, then, when you come to doing something about it, the question arises, where are you going to get the money? And then we come back to the banking issue. And we have this, what I call, infinitely silly banking system, where privately owned banks create almost all of the money that is created worldwide, certainly in countries like Canada, the United States, Britain, and Germany, and so on. And they create it out of thin air. It's just nothing. It's just a computer entry. That's all it is. But they create it all as debt. And the way the system works, most people don't understand this. They think that there has to be something more to it, but as the late John Kenneth Galbraith said, that the means by which banks create money is so simple that it's offensive to the mind. If you go in to get a loan for to buy a car, for example, and you want $35,000, the bank will ask you for collateral, and once you've given it to them, whether it's some stocks or bonds or a second mortgage on your house, or failing that, a signature of some rich relative or friend, they give you a note to sign for the $35,000, and they charge you interest on it at prime plus whatever, point or point and a half, depending on the color of your eyes. And, well, it's almost that arbitrary. Well, it is that arbitrary.
Right.
And then they type some computer keys, and presto, $35,000 appears in your account, which you can go out and spend if you want to buy the car. Seconds earlier, that money did not exist. But the problem is, it's created as debt, and it has to be repaid, and it has to be repaid with interest. Now, if all of the money in the world basically is created as debt, and debt on which interest has to be paid, and no one creates any money with which to pay the interest, what do you have to do? Well, you have to borrow more in order to pay the interest on what you already owe. And that's the situation the world is in today. And here you have an absolutely horrendous situation where you have millions and millions of people who are unemployed, who want to work to provide health care or education or install new bridges or fix up roads or rejuvenate the infrastructure of our countries and so on, just wishing very much to be able to do something creative. And they can't do it because there's no money. And the problem with the present regime, if you want to call it that, worldwide, is that they say, well, we can't afford to borrow anymore. Well, why do they have to borrow it? And you have to ask yourself, well, who owns the patent to the money, to create money? Well, the Congress in the United States has absolute power to create money, and the Parliament in Canada, and the Parliament in Great Britain, and so on. They have the patent. They own the patent, but they don't exercise it. They license it to privately owned banks. They don't collect a royalty on it, which is, you know, silly if you're giving a very valuable patent to somebody and don't even bother to collect a royalty. And then worse than that, if they need any money themselves, they have to borrow it from the licensees and pay high interest on it, which is just absolutely stupid. So what I've been trying to do and still doing and working at it almost full time is to say we have to change the system and roll back the time before Milton Friedman and his colleagues came along and set up a new regime that really made matters even worse than they had been before, and have the governments create part of the money. I'm suggesting 34%, which and the way I came on that number was because I think it would be enough to stop the increase in debt worldwide and to flatten out the debt-to-GDP ratio worldwide, and then to maybe slowly reduce it just marginally over a long period of time. But the advantage would be that they could get economies up and running and employ people and then do the things that have to be done, the whole list that I just went over, plus doing the things that have to be done for global warming. So it's absolutely essential. I've been writing some people in your country saying what is needed at the moment is a massive reflation. And the way this can be done, you know, I'm not alone in this. You have a lady in California, Ellen Hodgson Brown, who really understands, and she's the one that should be the Secretary of the Treasury, as far as I'm concerned. And she would fix the system up real fast because she would have the Treasury print probably $1 trillion and spend it into circulation and get people back to work. And of course, when they go back to work, they start to pay taxes, which reduces deficits and so on. And in effect, if the governments created even the 34% of the new money over time that I'm talking about, instead of worrying about the next recession and how the banks are going to save themselves without public input in the next recession, we can stop worrying because there'll never be another recession. And that has really been the focus of my whole life. And of course, so far I've been very unsuccessful in getting anybody to listen, but I'm still trying because it is so important. The future of the world, in my opinion, literally depends on changing the banking system and governments taking back some of that sovereign power that they have been giving up and not exercising. And they just absolutely have to exercise it for the benefit of all of their subjects, all of their electors and taxpayers, and do it right away so that that we have the resources necessary to do all of these ordinary things for instead of cutting back on education and so on that has been going on in U.S. states and Canadian provinces, and in our case, raising some taxes recently, some new taxes in Ontario that I find they're taking a bit of a bite. And, you know, and I'm not complaining because I haven't missed a square meal in a long time, but there are a lot of people who can't afford it. And it means that they then don't have what the economists call the disposable income to go out and generate new growth and new jobs. So we're just sitting in this sort of quicksand or morass or whatever it is. So this is what is necessary, and that's the number two item in the book. And then the number three.
If I may interrupt you for one second, I apologize. But the topic of global warming, I don't want to deviate. I want to come back to this because it's so important. But the global warming aspect, NASA has shown evidence that there are other planets that register higher temperatures than usual. So question number one, is this cyclical? I understand that perhaps we have a carbon footprint, but is it cyclical, one? And number two, could this be also to impose a carbon tax or cap and trade, as you probably have heard?
First of all, they're right if they say that, or at least I think they're right if they say that some other planets are having increases in temperature too.
Yeah.
So I'm not debating that. We can't do anything about that. We can't do anything about the sun. But we can do something about the gases that are yes. heating our planet. And so we have to do something about the things that we can do something about. I don't know if I put this in the book or not, because having written a number of books now, I can never remember for sure what facts are in which ones. But I, a number of years ago, was trying to kill some bats in the attic of an old farmhouse that was part of a tourist resort that my late wife and I ran for 45 years. Mm-hmm. And I winged a bat, and it fell and bit me on the arm.
Oh.
And it got away, so I couldn't tell which one it was to have it checked, you know, for rabies.
Yeah.
So I went to the doctor and discussed it with him. And he said, well, there's always the possibility of that the bat was rabid and mm-hmm. that you might get rabies. And I said, well, how many people have survived rabies? And he said, none yet. I decided to take the vaccine.
Sure.
Because you have to do what you can do. And we can stop global warming if we stop burning fossil fuels. There's just no question about it. And so that's what we should be doing. And that, of course, brings me back to the contribution of the extraterrestrials and their technology. That they, I am told, have, together with U.S. scientists who have been working in these areas for decades, going back to the early 1950s or late 1940s, have presumably developed some exotic fuels. And Dr. Michael Wolff,
Cravant, yeah.
Who you know, was one of the best witnesses who has gone public so far, said that they had developed both the cold fusion and zero-point energy. Well, I tend to believe them. But I also know that from what the extraterrestrials have said to all sorts of people who have talked to them, that they're terribly concerned about our planet and what's happening to it. And they want us to do something about it before it's too late. And so this technology is available, but it isn't being made available to the public because of the cover-up by the small cabal and what's largely often referred to as the shadow government in the United States.
Right.
And it has to be. And it has to be made available to the world. And I say in the book that even if it isn't in a form that is commercially viable at the present time, that the star visitors or brothers or whatever you want to call them would give us the technology if we would start trying to save our planet and trying to get along as human beings and stop making wars and more diabolical ways of killing each other and start cooperating. So this brings me to sort of the third point in the book, which is that the major religions have been fighting each other and killing each other for thousands of years, have got to stop. And they have to cooperate in building what I call the kingdom of God on earth, which I define as a world where every child has enough food to eat and some clean water to drink, a shirt on his or her back, and a little basic education, a little basic health care, and, you know, a roof over the head, just the basics to give them a decent sort of life and enough education, as I suggested, that they can see what their potential is and maybe that they can go on and make some real contribution to humankind overall. And this is what we should be cooperating in doing. And it seems to me that we have the wrong priorities when we spend trillions of dollars on weapons to kill each other instead of spending a good proportion of that money on doing all of the things that are necessary to end abject poverty and you know, starvation around the world, and to have the kind of civilization that some of the star visitors claim that they have, which is much more advanced than ours. So these things all tie in together. And the reason for writing the book, as you asked, was to confront leaders and others with the fact that what happens to the world is depends on us. If we don't do these right things, and the world really blows up, or we blow it up, or whatever, there are going to be people, religious people and others, who say, well, that's God's vengeance on us for what we did. But in fact, it will be that we brought it on ourselves, and that there's no way that a just God would ever do that sort of thing as punishment. But having given us the power of choice, if we are whatever the word should be, willful enough, or lackadaisical enough, or careless enough, or indifferent enough to just let it happen, well, then we can expect the terrible consequences that are going to come in the decades ahead.
And a lot of these situations, and let's go back again to the funny money or monopoly money, like we call it, you suggest that each sovereign country print 1/3 of their currency by their treasuries. But instead of, for example, in the United States, there was a proposal to audit the Federal Reserve here. However, instead of auditing, shouldn't we be abolishing these cabals? Because that's what they are. It's private banks who basically rule the lives of the entire planet. What if they said, that's it, we're just like Kennedy tried to do, let's print our own currency here. That way we don't have to pay interest. As you said, it's a patent. We're not getting paid royalties. So why even allow that to continue? Is it because presidents and leaders around the world don't want to face what President Kennedy faced, the ultimate price?
I doubt it, frankly. I think it's because the leaders don't understand the system. They don't know where money comes from. They don't know what money is in many cases. And if they go to most of the economic schools, no one's going to tell them. And so it's basically ignorance of how the system really works. And they have been brainwashed into believing that the system that we have, that has just grown like Topsy over, well, about two centuries, is the one we're stuck with. Most of them don't know, for example, the evolution of the degree of leverage. You can go way back. I start in England back before the time of the Bank of England was established, when the rich people in London, because the king had stolen their money from the mint in the Tower of London, the rich people put their savings into the hands of the goldsmiths, and they got deposit slips.
Yes.
And then the goldsmiths paid them, I think it was 5% interest on it, on the understanding they could lend it to their friends at a higher interest rate. So this, in effect, they soon found that they could lend more money than they had in their vaults, because people didn't come in and get their coins, certainly not all at once. And so the way it worked is that found it a lot easier to take goldsmiths' notes if they were going to buy a fur coat for their wife or something like that than it would be to go and get a whole sack full of gold coins. And so, in effect, because the goldsmiths were lending more than they had in their vaults, this was a scam and it was illegal, but it was legitimized when the Bank of England was formed. and the King William had been fighting this war in Europe and ran out of money, somebody said, well, why don't you form a bank? Why don't you get your friends to start a bank? So he did, and they put in £1,200,000 pounds in gold and silver and lent it all to the king at 8%, which is a pretty high interest rate for a guaranteed loan. And then to show his appreciation, the king and the government said, now you can print, P-R-I-N-T, and they actually did, another £1,200,000 pounds in banknotes and lend them to your friends at high interest rates. So in effect, they were lending the same money twice. Well, then in the early days of the 20th century, in the United States, the federally chartered banks had to have a gold reserve of 25%. So in effect, those banks were allowed to lend the same money four times. And when I was a younger man in Canada, the banks had to have an 8% cash reserve, which meant they were allowed to lend the same money 12 and a half times. Well, recently, they've got that leverage up to about 20 to 1.
Right.
And this is nothing but legalized fraud. Because if you stop to think about it, if you had a room to rent or a pasture to rent or something or other, and you rented it to 20 different people and collected rent from each one of them, you'd wind up in jail. And yet the banking consortium can get away with lending the same money 20 times to 20 different people at the same time and collecting interest on it from each one of them. And so this is a unique situation in the world and one that is really intolerable. I think a ratio of even 3 to 1, which is what I'm proposing they be allowed in the future, is generous, but I think it would be a useful function they could play. They could still afford to create money for legitimate expansion of small business and medium-sized businesses and to consumers and so on, the things that they had the moral requirement to do when they were given their licenses in effect to create money, they would still have that capacity, but they would no longer have the capacity to create huge, huge sums for the richest and wealthiest people in the world to buy up all of the assets and to consolidate these huge companies and to finance hedge funds and to make a world lottery with their, you know, all of these incredibly complex investments that they have been getting involved in that have put the entire world financial system at risk, and of course, which ultimately led to the meltdown.
But a man of your stature, would you propose, instead of the one-third, would you propose the abolition so that countries like Canada, the United States, would you propose the abolition of these printing money out of thin air banking fraudsters?
No, and I explain in both my books, because in addition to Light at the End of the Tunnel, I've just republished an economics book called A Miracle in Waiting, Economics of Common Sense. And I explain the reason, and that is that the banks, first of all, they employ a lot of people. Secondly, they're a decent investment for a lot of retirement funds. Thirdly, they have a function to play. They know how to distribute credit profitably, in theory at least, and that is a function that they are really better, in my opinion, better qualified to do than politicians. I guess what I'm saying, finally, is that I don't trust politicians to create all of the money any more than I do bankers, because having been in the business all of my life, I know that they would be just as subject to cronyism and just as subject to temptation and corruption as the present system. And so what I'm talking about is one of the principles on which the United States was founded, and that is checks and balances. And if you reduce this 20 to 1 leverage to 3 to 1, believe me, that would be like taking the wings off the eagles as far as the banking system is concerned. No more high flying, no more money for hedge funds and derivatives and all of this sort of thing. And just enough left to do what they were supposed to do and what they were expected to do when the legislatures gave them this extraordinary power. And still, governments would have enough money from their 34% to balance their budgets at all levels, the federal and state and municipal levels, and to meet the needs of the people without going further into debt and in fact, reducing the existing debt over a period of time. And, of course, in the process of getting the banks up to a 34% cash reserve, that would give governments a lot of leeway. I don't want to try and explain that on the radio, but it would give governments a lot of leeway to make extraordinary expenditures to stimulate the economy and then to take over some of the assets of the banks and or reduce the government debt considerably, probably, you know, by 20 or 25% over a very short period of time, and use some of it maybe to pay off a third world debt and developing world debt and some to reduce their own debt so that the world is has a balanced and sort of common sense level of existence for everyone.
But you see, people in the United States, a lot of them don't know that the money they pay to the IRS does not go into paying services and goods that the government uses. It goes into paying interest on the debt. And those who are...
Paying the interest on the debt.
Exactly. And those who are printing the money know that we'll never be able to repay it 100%. And the way they do this, print more, create inflation, and that continues to saddle the population around the world. Isn't this a point of no return for that?
Well, there's no way that the debt can be ever paid off. I guess in theory, you could pay off a lot of it if you went to 100% cash reserves.
Mm-hmm.
But I just... First of all, I don't think it's politically possible. Coming back to Milton Friedman for all of his frailties, he was, for most of his career, a promoter of 100% cash reserves. And he learned this at the feet of Floyd Mintz and the others, members of the original Chicago School from the 1930s. And they were, as a result of the Great Depression, they were promoting some very radical ideas. And they suggested going to 100% cash reserves. And so Friedman, for much of his life, promoted that idea. But then he came to the conclusion that it was politically impossible. And so he did what I consider to be highly irrational. He went from 100% cash reserves to zero. And this flip-flop, I keep saying, you have to wonder about the judgment of a man who goes from one extreme to the other without saying, hey, how about 50 or 40 or 30 or 60 or some figure in between 100 and zero?
Black or white, not gray.
Yeah, right. But he turned out to be right in one respect. He thought that 0% would be more politically saleable, and he was absolutely right because Canada, for example, in 1991, changed the Bank Act and went to zero reserves. And so our banks are not required to have any cash reserves whatsoever. And they only have enough to, you know, to give you a few bucks if you're going somewhere on the weekend and want a little cash in your pocketbook in case you have to pay somebody to pull you out of the ditch or you have to want to buy some fresh vegetables along the highway or something like that. And our banks probably have about a cent or a cent and a half in legal tender for every dollar that people think they have on deposit. So that just shows you how distorted the whole system has become and the need for doing something really substantial about it. And for many years, I have to admit, I was promoting 50-50, 50% cash reserves and 50%, you know, like a 2-to-1 ratio for the banks instead of 3-to-1. And this was sort of a compromise position, but I think that too would be impossible to sell politically. And you have to be realistic. We live in a real world, not a hypothetical world, not a perfect world. And I think that the 34% solution, as I call it, is one that even if we could bring that into effect, it would have more impact on the future of the world than any other move that could be taken at the present time, bar none, except except a nuclear war. So.
Do you have the equivalent in Canada of the, well, we have here the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Company? And I ask because if you have a 0% requirement of reserves, what happens if everybody all of a sudden wants to withdraw their money?
Well, the same thing that would happen here. It doesn't exist.
Right.
So what happened, of course, is, and our people claim it didn't happen, but the Bank of Canada created $75 billion to buy mortgages from the Canadian banks, and they were transferred over to what we call Canada Housing and Mortgage Corporation. And it's in exactly the same way that the Federal Reserve printed $1.2 trillion for all of the things that that you did in bailing out banks and General Motors and so on. And that money, and I think it was Congressman Paul who got Ben Bernanke to admit this, that money was just created out of thin air. It was just a computer entry. That's all it was. And it's just that easy to do something if you just could get the theory right. And I say that it is, on my book, I say that it is a crime against humanity in the literal sense of those words to have such high levels of unemployment when something could be done about it in 24 hours by simply creating enough money to start the economy rolling and expanding again.
And that term that you use, crime against humanity, I use it all the time. And when we start talking about the 60-plus year truth embargo, I'll tell you why. But you say in the book, the world is going to hell in a handbasket, and we have to do something about it now. What do we need to do?
Well, we have to change the banking system immediately. I say it's the most urgent. I think the global warming is the most important. But I think changing the banking system is most urgent. Because if we don't change the banking system, we can't finance the change in technology that would be required to stop global warming. The federal governments around the world just don't have it. You're talking about trillions of dollars a year if you were to try and switch from fossil fuels to, say, cold fusion or whatever we come up with in 10 years. It's physically possible. But at the moment, there are no finances to do it. There's no money there, and you're not going to get federal governments to borrow that much money and increase debts that much, because the idea of reduced deficits is firmly embedded in people's heads, and it's a good idea once you figure out how to do it without causing havoc in the real economy. So the number one thing that has to be done is to change the banking system. And then number two, parallel, can go on at the same time, is to start using the money that's created to do all of the things that have to be done, from healthcare and so on, right through to providing massive employment in the installation of new exotic technologies. And then the third thing, of course, is that to make sure that that people all over the world have a little bit of a share in it. And that means making sure that these things aren't subject to high royalties, or that they aren't kept secret as they are now and so on, and that they're available for the world, and that people in the United States, regardless of their religion and so on, say, hey, we're all one. We're all God's children, and we have to work as one unit to save the world and to make it the kind of world that we could be proud of, and that would be one of peace and tranquility. And it can be done, but it takes a lot of change of heart and mind from where we are at the moment.
And as I was saying before your last statement, crime against humanity, you are someone with experience and are respected not only in Canada but around the world. The United States government has imposed a 60-plus year truth embargo on the reality about visitors from other planets and their technology. At a grassroots level, what can we do to open the gates of the biggest secret that keeps the human race enslaved? And the reason why I say crime against humanity is because if the technology exists, zero-point energy, cold fusion, anti-gravity, people wouldn't be dying in airplane crashes. People will not be dying because they don't have money to extract water because desalinization plants require electricity. You see my point?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you're asking the wrong person because I've, for full disclosure, and I've found, I've had critics a couple of times recently in broadcast, and they say, hey, full disclosure would cause chaos. And I have now promised to add that when I say full disclosure, I don't mean that everything that is known by everybody is going to be in tomorrow's papers. I mean that a suitable body would be set up, a body of investigation that would start looking into all of these areas, and that the it'd probably take 3 to 6 months to establish it, and then probably a year or two of skirmishing and getting out the kinds of information that some of us already have about the existence of UFOs and the existence of the underground works and in Nevada and Arizona and New Mexico, and so on. But it would probably be 2 or 3 years before all of the things that are being done were public knowledge. And then the other thing that I mentioned in the book, and this I admit was not original with me, came with Jim Sparks, who was one of the principal abductees that I had the pleasure of interviewing at some length before I wrote my book.
Sure.
Is the amnesty, and he got the idea from the extraterrestrials themselves, because in the process of keeping or trying to keep this business secret for so long, and it's been amazingly successful when you think of it, and you think of the number of people who still don't know what is going on, or when I say still don't know, don't even have a concept of what is going on. You have to tip your hat to the people who have been running the disinformation programs and telling the lies and making those of us who are trying to tell the truth look as if we'd been having too much Jack Daniels or something like that.
Exactly. Yes.
And so they really have done a pretty terrific job, but in the process, they have broken just about every law in the book. And so if you want them to come and start telling the truth, although some of the retirees now are doing that, but if you want to get at the whole truth, you're going to have to change the law and grant amnesty by one means or another to the people who come and give witnesses to what has been going on and is going on at the present time, and that is otherwise they just won't do it. Their memories will go bad, and they won't be able to remember what they were doing 5 years ago or 10 years ago, because if they remembered everything, why, they would probably find themselves in real trouble with the law. So when I say full disclosure, I don't mean an overnight revelation of everything that's been going on, because it would be impossible. There's so much information that it's going to take months for people to absorb the bits and pieces that come out. And that's the reason I think we should start right away, because we've got to get to the good stuff, as I call it, or in some cases the bad stuff that's been going on there, the development of even more effective ways of killing people and doing all sorts of things. In order to get to that, it's going to take time and sort of working the way through the system until all of that information is finally made public. Not going to happen overnight, but it's not going to happen at all if the people who have been responsible for it are know that they're going to be in trouble if they tell the truth.
And you know Stephen Bassett and Richard Dolan, and we cannot block the sun with our hand. If we were to disclose 100%, we can't forget that right now the oil industry rules. If we remove that overnight, the economy of the world will collapse. I understand that.
Well, yeah, except you can't do it overnight.
I understand. It would have to be in a slow, measured transition. But if you were the leader of your country, how would you handle disclosure?
Oh, I would set up a commission with the, you know, the best lawyers in the country to start getting the truth out bit by bit. And having first had the legislature pass the necessary legislation to give provide immunity to the witnesses, and then get it out. In this case, I would probably, if I were in the United States or if Canada had something comparable, which we do not, I would probably go for the energy aspect fairly early on because it is so critically important, because we can't just fool around for 5 or 10 years. Now, to come back to this business of the economy collapsing, this is this is really, I think, a red herring, because if you're introducing new technology as you replace an old technology, you're introducing new jobs and all sorts of fantastic possibilities as old ones disappear. And this has happened before. You know, I can remember when after the war, when some of the coal dealers I know started selling oil, and the ones that started selling oil survived, and the ones that stuck to coal didn't. But there's a transition, and as long as you go with the flow, you start introducing a new technology, and it just sort of comes in like a tide, and it replaces the other one that goes out like a tide. And that's what's got to happen. And as far as wreaking havoc in the economy is concerned, I don't believe it. And I think, of course, it would be disruptive if I was the owner of a corner franchise for selling gas. I would want to spend a lot of my time figuring out how I could get in on the new stuff right at the beginning and take advantage of that.
That's a very good point. I remember in the 80s when I worked in the financial industry, there were about 15, 20 people in my office. 10 years before, there were about 85 people in the same office. The computer replaced them. And everybody thought, my God, the computers are going to be taking over, robots, etc. But everybody got a job doing something new, because computers replace people, yes, but created new industries. So it's the same here with the new technologies, right?
Exactly.
And we have to take our one and only intermission, Mr. Hillier, but I want to tell the audience, this book, it's a great read. I have it right here with me, Light at the End of the Tunnel, A Survival Plan for the Human Species. How can people buy it?
Well, I guess in the United States, they're probably just from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, although any good bookstore should be able to order it from Author House, who did the publishing. But whether you'd have to try that. If you've got a favorite bookstore, why try it? But if not, by the tried and true easy methods, or again to go with the big guy and the big guys, and they can produce it.
And do you have a website, a way where people can actually look more of your work?
Yes, I do have a website, and I'm going to have to leaf over my book here to make sure I get it right. I think it's paulhillier.net.com. And because
isn't it paulhillierweb.com?
Yeah, you're right. paulhillierweb.com. You've got it right.
And I just making sure.
There are too many things. There are too many codes and things that I'm trying to remember these days, and I can't get them all sorted out in my mind.
Well, let's take a quick intermission. Folks, we are so privileged to have the Honorable Paul Hillier with us. There's so much more to cover. Please don't go anywhere. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to The Veritas Show. We'll be right back. Thank you very much for listening. We're going to talk more with our special guest in our members section. Head on over to our website, veritasshow.com, click on subscribe, and join us in the members area to tune in to the second part of this great show. We'll take a short break, listen to some music, and we'll be right back with more.
This is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to The Veritas Show.